headlines this hour. President Ebrahim Raisi says that Iran will not give up its peaceful nuclear rights. A Palestinian is killed and over a dozen injured in an armed confrontation with Israeli forces who raided the Jenin refugee camp. And Pakistan's parliament adjourns before a planned vote on ousting Prime Minister Imran Khan. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran marks its National Nuclear Technology Day. The capital, Tehran, has hosted a ceremony introducing the latest achievements in nuclear technology. Top officials, including President Ebrahim Raisi and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, were in attendance. Raisi hailed extensive research works by Iranian scientists using peaceful nuclear energy. He pledged that his government would continue to support the process. The Iranian president emphasized his country's right to peaceful nuclear energy. He also described as irreversible Iran's technological know-how in the nuclear field.
Iran's nuclear energy program has redefined the country's domestic and foreign policies since the country indigenized the industry. Every year, on April 9th, Iran showcases the latest nuclear achievements to mark National Nuclear Technology Day. With President Ebrahim Raisi in attendance, the ceremony this year saw the unveiling of 9 new products out of a total of 77 pieces of nuclear-related equipment produced recently. The president boasted that Iran's nuclear advances were made while the country was under Western pressure.
They didn't want us to have our own domestic nuclear industry. They tried their best to stop us. They assassinated our nuclear scientists. They imposed sanctions and even targeted our nuclear facilities with explosions. But here we are treading our path toward greater success in the nuclear industry.
Today, we have extended our nuclear know-how to an extent that we can use it in a range of industries such as agriculture and health, such as radio medicine. We will generate 10,000 megawatts of nuclear-powered electricity and are planning to build an entirely domestic 360-megawatt nuclear power plant.
The event comes as Iran and the world powers are wrapping up talks over the revival of the 2015 deal, which promised Tehran sanctions relief in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The accord has faced trouble since the U.S. unilaterally left it in 2018 and reinstated anti-Iran sanctions. That prompted Iran and other signatories to the accord to launch the Vienna talks to fix the ailing deal.
You know, we have already finished the discussions and negotiation there. As you have heard from our foreign minister, it is time for decision. They have to make difficult decision. That depends, of course, to them to decide if really they want to come back to the deal. This is the Americans that they have to decide. Of course, we are working in an organization dealing with technical issues, not with political issues. But we are looking forward to see that if there is a deal there, then we will implement the deal based on our obligations.
Iran designated April 9th as the Nuclear Technology Day back in 2006, when the country enriched uranium on an industrial scale for the first time. Since then, the country has seen a steady progress in the sector, from building nuclear power plants to centrifuges and radiopharmaceuticals. So Nuclear Technology Day is seen as an occasion for the country to reaffirm its right to a peaceful nuclear energy program.
Sanctions have been haunting Iran's nuclear program since the country indigenized the key sector. Tehran calls the sanctions illegal and unfair, for it has insisted before the conclusion of the 2015 deal, up until now when the Vienna talks are underway, that weapons of mass destruction have no place on the Islamic Republic's agenda, and that its nuclear program is totally civilian. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinians hold a funeral for a Palestinian shot dead by Israeli forces in the Jenin refugee camp, north of the occupied West Bank. At least 5 Palestinians were also injured in the shootout. Israeli troops raided the camp and besieged the home of a young Palestinian man who was allegedly behind a shooting in Tel Aviv on Thursday night. A number of Israeli forces were injured in the ensuing firefight and were airlifted to medical centers. During the Tel Aviv shooting, at least 3 Israelis were killed and 8 more wounded. Israeli regime forces later killed the Palestinian shooter.
Tel Aviv has been the scene of yet another Palestinian operation. On Thursday, a Palestinian man opened fire at Israelis in the heart of a city, killing three and injuring eight others. He was shot dead by Israeli forces after a nine-hour manhunt. Palestinian resistance groups praised the attack as a heroic operation, calling it a natural response to Israeli crimes. The Popular Resistance Committee, a coalition of a number of armed Palestinian groups, says the operation exposed the regime's fragility and weakness. The comments were echoed by Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah, which hailed the recent shooting operation in Tel Aviv as a legitimate response to crimes committed by the Israeli regime. Thursday's attack was the fourth such operation in the past 2 weeks. Late last month, a Palestinian shooting operation killed five people in a Tel Aviv suburb. Attacks in the northern city of Hadera and the southern city of Beersheba had killed six Israelis days earlier. But the question is, what's behind the uptick in the number of attacks that's been described as one of the deadliest waves of Palestinian operations in years?
We are suffering daily from their homes being confiscated, their lives being taken, children being arrested on an almost daily basis and taken off to jail. So for every action, there is a reaction, and repression builds resistance. So I think we are seeing an outcry of despair, but also a strengthening of resistance against the continued illegal occupation of the West Bank.
As tensions mount in the occupied territories, Israel is bracing for more Palestinian operations in the days to come.
The United States, the European Union, and the United Nations have slammed the Palestinian operation in Tel Aviv, but the condemnations of Israeli crimes against Palestinians have been few and far between. Experts believe that such double standards give Israel the leeway to commit more atrocities against the Palestinian people.
The events that are unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of hostilities that culminated in the 11-day war on Gaza in May last year, during which over 250 Palestinians, including scores of women and children, were killed in the besieged enclave. The international community called for an immediate end to the war, but stopped short of condemning Israel for the deadly and devastating onslaught after it was over. The world also seems to have turned a blind eye to Israel's land grab and expansionist policies that see hundreds of Palestinian-owned structures razed to the ground every year. The years-long blockade on Gaza Strip, settlers' violence against Palestinians, and Israel's illegal settlement construction activities also seem to be going unnoticed. When some Arab states announced the normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering.
You've mentioned all the usual suspects who give political coverage and the fig leaf of respectability to the apartheid Israeli regime, remembering that Israel is a white colonial European colonization project within the Middle East. But you've left out the other group of people, the other organization that have condemned Palestinian violence, but have not condemned Israeli violence, and that is the Palestinian Authority, which is led by the unelected Mahmoud Abbas. So while all these other people are held to account for their failure to hold to account Israeli apartheid atrocities and war crimes, let us not forget the PA and Mahmoud Abbas.
In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
Earlier, we reached out to journalist and commentator Marwa Usman for her take on the recent round of Palestinians' operations against the Israeli regime.
What we are looking at right now is a basic ignition to an upcoming wave, a shock wave that the Israeli regime will be feeling on all of its occupied territories. And it is a legitimate right for the Palestinians to fight for their existence, for their right to exist on their own land and to defend the liberty and the freedom of their people. So it took them a lot of time to understand that. And I think right now what they are going through is just a simple example of what might happen if everyone worked homogeneously at the same time in all of occupied Palestine, in all of the occupied territories. Add to that, if Gaza gets on board, it would be a total chaos inside of the occupied territories for the Zionist occupation forces. And I think that the mere fact that the Zionists are colonial settlers, they can never be safe from the retaliatory attacks of the Palestinian natives. It's basic history. But the Israelis were living in a lie, and the biggest lie, therefore, was the normalization that happened in the past couple of years, which ended in a basic opening of arms by certain Persian Gulf Arab states to the Israeli entity, thinking that this will just drag the Palestinians into a coercive, peaceful solution when their lives are at stake here. But that did not happen.
Pakistan's parliament has been adjourned before a planned vote on whether Prime Minister Imran Khan should stay in office. Speaker of the legislative body, Asad Qaisar, did not give a reason for halting the session, but he said the assembly will reconvene later on Saturday. Imran Khan was vowed to struggle against any move to replace him. He insists that he is a victim of a regime change conspiracy involving the U.S. Pakistan got embroiled into a political crisis last week after a key ally of the ruling party switched side, prompting the opposition to issue a no-trust motion. However, Khan blocked the process and dissolved parliament. After days of hearings late on Thursday, the Supreme Court announced Khan's move as unlawful. Ukraine is calling for harsher sanctions against Russia after a missile attack hit a train station in the eastern city of Kramatorsk. That attack left 52 people dead. President Volodymyr Zelensky says the strike was a deliberate attack on civilians and a war crime. He says that Kyiv expects a firm global response and called for an energy embargo on Russia. Zelensky also called for all Russian banks to be cut off from the global system and demanded more weapons. He says that any delay in providing arms for Ukraine would mean politicians want to help Moscow more than Kyiv. The Kremlin at the same time has urged the West to stop supplying weapons to Kyiv and blamed the Ukrainian military for the Kramatorsk attack.
Today, on April 8th, the Ukrainian military struck the railway station of Kramatorsk with a Tochka-U missile. Tochka-U missiles, which remains were found near the railway station, are used only by the Ukrainian military.
Russia's defense ministry also says the missiles were launched from a Donbas territory controlled by Ukrainian forces. The conflict is now in its 45th day. According to the UN's Human Rights Office, over 1,600 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. More than 2,200 others have been injured, while another 11,000 have lost or left their homes. Footage has been released, apparently showing Ukrainian soldiers executing a Russian prisoner of war outside of a village west of the capital, Kyiv. In the video, at least three men can be seen lying dead next to a fourth, who is breathing heavily with a jacket covering his head. Then a voice is heard, saying that he's still breathing. Afterwards, a soldier shoots the man twice in the head. The man continues to move. The soldier shoots again, and he stops. The living soldiers in the video are wearing the Ukrainian colors of blue and yellow on their arms. The men on the floor wear white armbands, which are used by Russian troops. The video was first shared on Telegram, and some Western media outlets have verified it. The Ukrainian government has pledged an investigation. The number of Ukrainian refugees fleeing war in their country has topped 4.4 million. That's according to the UN Refugee Agency. The UNHCR has registered nearly 60,000 refugees in one day. This is Europe's biggest refugee crisis since World War II. Poland has been their main destination, from which many of them travel to other European countries. 90% of those who have fled Ukraine are women and children. Men of military age are not allowed to leave. The UN says that around 210,000 non-Ukrainians have also fled the country. The World Body also estimates that over 7 million people have been displaced within the country. That means that around one-third of the Ukrainian population has been forced to flee their homes since the war began on November 24th. Just one day ahead of France's presidential polls, the race for the top job is reaching its climax. The two main rivals, incumbent Emmanuel Macron and far-right leader Marine Le Pen, are making last-minute appeals to win more votes. Still, there are indications that a large segment of the French public might be reluctant to cast their ballots because they're unhappy with the presidential campaign and the status quo in general. Our correspondent in Paris, Rami Mazare, tells us more.
Well, it's been a very surprising election in that nobody has seemed to care about it, not in the rest of the world or in France. That's really very different from 2017, when neither of the two mainstream parties made it to the second round for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. What Ukraine really did is provide Macron with a way to avoid campaigning. So he didn't have his first campaign until about a week ago. So he has been criticized as hiding behind the campaign. Hiding behind Ukraine to avoid campaigning. What the French people care about is it's always been the same. It's been purchasing power. Inflation has just soared in recent months. It's at gut-wrenching levels now for the average household. Well, the far right is really gaining ground for many reasons. It's been a process. You have Nicolas Sarkozy, who introduced Islamophobia. You have François Hollande, who made it mainstream, who made it acceptable. And now you have Macron's term, which has institutionalized Islamophobia. So what we see here is not the far right gaining ground in sort of one section of the population, but that all of France has become more far right on this cultural issue of immigration, Islam, Muslims.
And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. 14 centuries ago, when the entire Arabian Peninsula was plunged in ignorance and superstitions, the messenger of mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "Fast to be healthy." It is believed in different religions that fasting is useful for both the body and the spirit. Fasting has been prescribed for other religions before Islam, and even some of non-Abrahamic religions have had a form of fasting in a specific period in year or for specific purposes. Stay tuned, please. Fasting was there among Christians and Jews. Interestingly, the non-Abrahamic religions had also called on their followers to refrain from eating during specific days. In ancient Greek, people used to go to famous temple for treatment of their sickness. Then they would fast after bathing and would ask the relevant deity to cure their patient. Hinduism has prevailed in the subcontinent and adjacent regions since 3,000 or 4,000 years BC. The adherents of this religion usually fast on the first days of the new month and during religious festivities. Fasting in this religion includes full refraining from solid foods and drinks for 24 hours, and everyone decides on how to fast. The aim of this fasting is to increase the thought and internal refining. The followers of Buddhism usually fast on the 14th day of every month, abstaining from solid foods. The followers of Manichaeism used to observe certain rituals during fasting. They had two kinds of fasting. One of them included abstention from eating and drinking for 2 days, and the other one was from morning till evening. The temples of Manichaeans were called Manistan, and there were 5 salons in every temple, one of which was related to fasting people and their prayers. They would determine the time of fast according to astrological evidence and would celebrate the last day of the month. They used to confess their sins while holding the picture of Manichaeus. Some historical accounts show that fast was common even among idolaters. It was done for satisfying idols. Why has fasting been so prevalent among various nations and various creeds? This may have originated in the fact that the first person who fasted was Prophet Adam. According to the narrations, when Adam ate from the forbidden tree, it was in his stomach for 30 days. Hence, God obligated 30 days of abstention from eating and drinking for him and his race. So, fasting has been inherited from our forefathers. Exegetes and experts of Islamic sciences have discussed if the blessed month of Ramadan had been called the same among the past nations or not. Some say that Ramadan is the name that had been there since the era of ignorance. Others maintain that Ramadan is the name that Islam has put on the month. Some others believe that when months were being called, they were called according to the time they coincided with. For instance, Ramadan was called such as it coincided with intensive heat of summer. Yet, there is evidence that Ramadan was called the same even before Islam. This is true for Dhul-Hajjah too. Generally, any nation that was beleaguered by a trouble or calamity, it would vow to fast and worship God. This way, they would show their misery and inability and confess their sins to satisfy God. God says in Ayah 183 of Surah Baqarah that fasting had been prescribed in the religions before Islam. Here, God wants to say that although fasting may seem hard, it had been prescribed for other nations and religions before Islam. God also stresses that the aim of fasting is to gain God-weariness. Fasting has been mentioned in the Old and New Testaments. It is said in the Bible that in all times among every ethnicity and nation, fasting was common during sorrows and unexpected trouble. The Bible of Luke reads that Prophet Jesus ordered his disciples to fast after his death. We also read in the Torah that Prophet Moses fasted for 40 days. It has also been mentioned in the Torah that the Jews used to fast when they wanted to express humbleness on the order to gain God's satisfaction. The Noble Quran is a great book which will remove curtains and show us realities if we contemplate its ayahs with pure heart. Today, scientists have reached the fact that there are myriads of mysteries in different parts of this book. God says in Ayah 29 of Surah Sa'd, "It is a blessed book that we have sent down to you, so that they may contemplate its signs and that those who possess intellect may take admonition." God has mentioned the aim of sending down the Quran so that people are not content with mere recitation of its ayahs. They are rather recommended to reflect upon the meanings of ayahs to be admonished. The commander of the faithful and the leader of the pious, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "Think deeply on the ayahs of the Quran, because thinking deeply and reflection on the Quran is the spring of hearts."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
A new book has revealed how the United States' top spying organization, the Central Intelligence Agency, carried out destabilization operations in Africa for decades. Now, the CIA not only undermined newly independent African countries, but suppressed the freedom movement in apartheid South Africa. A tip from a CIA spy to authorities in apartheid-era South Africa led to Nelson Mandela's arrest, beginning the leader's 27 years behind bars. Nelson Mandela's eldest daughter, Makeziwe, speaks here on CIA's role in the arrest of Madiba in 1962.
I are surprised. And if one, we read a lot, we know of a lot of other shenanigans that the CIA has done in other countries.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on a new book which discusses how the CIA undermined newly independent African countries in operations that included assassination of leaders who were opposed to Western imperialism. In the second part of our program, we shall look at how Mauritius has taken a bold step to challenge Britain's colonial control over Chagos Islands.
CIA crimes in Africa. Historian Susan Williams has written a new book titled White Malice, the CIA and the Neocolonization of Africa. In her book, Williams uncovers secret operations pursued by the CIA from Ghana to Congo to the UN in an effort to frustrate and deny and rob Africa of nationalist leaders committed to protecting the continent's resources.
Now, this book is said to be the first comprehensive account disclosing a Western dirty war through detailed quotes from original documents and by those involved. Now, to discuss the destructive destabilization operations carried out by the CIA in Africa, we contacted Margaret Kimberley, the co-founder of Black Agenda for Peace. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our first question to you, Ms. Kimberley. Now, what is the significance of the title of the book, White Malice, in terms of the racist outlook by the CIA?
Well, I think it sums it up very well, actually. The CIA picked up where the Europeans left off as they ended in, I believe in name only in many cases, they ended their colonization of Africa. But as in other regions of the world, the U.S. picks up for them and does what they were doing, secures resources, makes sure that governments that would actually work in the interests of the people don't come to power, and if they do, to damage them and make sure that they cannot do what they intend. And it is based on race. It is racism. So I think the title White Malice is quite appropriate. It's about how racism manifests itself in foreign policy.
One of the first targets of the CIA in Africa was the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is one of Africa's most richly endowed countries in terms of mineral wealth. The CIA was deeply involved in the assassination of Congo's independence leader, Patrice Lumumba, who had vowed to protect the country's minerals from looting by Western countries. Why was the CIA obsessed with strangling the independence of African countries?
Well, they wanted to make sure they were not ever truly independent. So in the case of Congo, for example, Patrice Lumumba is the first president post-Belgian colonialism, but he talked about, for example, nationalizing that country's resources. So has, you know, Congo has everything from diamonds to copper to gold, everything the world needs. And the idea of those resources not being in the hands of the capitalist West was something they would not put up with. So that is just one example.
During the Cold War era, the United States, which claims to advocate for democracy, supported the most brutal African dictators. For instance, after the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the CIA installed Mobutu Sese Seko as a president who ruled Congo with an iron fist for 32 years and even changed the name of the country to Zaire. Here is one of Mobutu's visits to Washington where he met the then U.S. President Ronald Reagan.
And I am pleased to have been able to meet again with President Mobutu who's been a faithful friend of the United States for some 20 years. The President and I took this opportunity to review the state of U.S.-Zairean relations, and we found a large area of agreement on the major points we discussed.
After independence of African countries, the CIA continued its malicious meddling in the continent by installing puppet regimes. Now, Ms. Kimberly, how did these affect development in Africa?
Well, it meant that the leadership of the leaders of African nations did not act in the interests of their people. They acted in the interest of those outside. So in the case of Congo, that mineral wealth could have been used for the benefit of the people there. Instead, it enriched collaborators, enriched the corporations in Europe and the United States. So the goal of this meddling, in fact, was to make sure that Africa remained underdeveloped.
Now, CIA operations were not confined to plots ending in brute force. Some were cultural programs, and most African artists and scholars who received CIA sponsorship were not aware of the funding source. Peter Kaline, an expert on Cold War and decolonization, speaks here during an event discussing modernism, African literature, and the CIA. Let's take a listen.
It's not widely discussed, even among scholars of African literature, that the CIA was the most active and influential patron of Anglophone African writing during the 1960s. Through its European affiliate, the Congress for Cultural Freedom, the CIA dispersed funds to many of Africa's emerging cultural institutions, although the real source of the funding was hidden from the recipients, and that's important to keep in mind. The first major international symposium on African literature, the Conference of African Writers of English Expression at Kampala's Makerere University in 1962, was sponsored by the Congress for Cultural Freedom. The CIA supplied programming for African radio with the Transcription Center, a London-based recording studio and clearinghouse for African cultural materials. Black Orpheus, the Nigerian Arts Review, and Transition, the slick cultural magazine started in Uganda, were both supported by CIA subventions. The Mbari Club in Nigeria, the Kemkemi Arts Center in Kenya were also beneficiaries of CIA interest in African art and literature.
The CIA is currently said to be operating remote-controlled aircraft and other drones from a secret base in Niger. The covert objectives of this CIA outpost in this mineral-rich area of Africa remain unknown. There is concern that the CIA base is a hub for destabilizing the region. Is the CIA currently pursuing its malicious programs of infiltration and destabilization of Africa?
Yes, the CIA is still doing the same thing, and they work in, obviously the CIA works on behalf of the U.S., but it works very closely with European nations, such as France, for example, which still has quite a military presence in Africa. We've had, since 2008, the U.S.-Africa Command, which actually puts U.S. troops on African soil. So these are the ways in which the CIA still does its same handiwork.
U.S. meddling in Africa, and particularly the Democratic Republic of Congo, is done to pave way for looting by major multinationals. Recently, U.S. tech giants Google parent Alphabet, Apple, Dell, Microsoft, and Tesla were taken to court for use of child labor in Congo to mine cobalt, a key ingredient of batteries in electric cars and consumer electronics. A lawyer for the victims speaks here on the case.
We traced the supply chain back from the mine where the children were either killed or maimed, and have traced it back up to these companies.
Now, last question. Do you think African governments and people can thwart and resist destructive CIA activities across the continent?
It's difficult but not impossible for Africans to thwart these activities. What African countries really need are revolutionary governments. And that's obviously something that the U.S. and Europe do not want and fight against. But mass action can change things.
Thank you very much, Margaret Kimberley, co-founder of the Black Agenda Report. Now, indeed, as our guest said, if people of Africa are determined, they can resist United States meddling in the continent. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss about the recent move by Mauritius to challenge Britain's colonial control over Chagos Islands.
Challenging Britain's colonial control over Chagos.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The flag of Mauritius was recently raised for the first time on the Chagos Islands. This is an Indian Ocean archipelago that is part of Mauritius but currently illegally occupied by Britain and is also home to a United States military base. The flag was raised after Mauritius dispatched a survey ship to the Chagos Islands to press the country's claim for the strategically located and important Indian Ocean archipelago.
The Prime Minister of Mauritius said it's the first time Mauritius has embarked upon an expedition to the islands without seeking the permission of the UK. The ship was carrying the Mauritian permanent representative to the United Nations, along with scientists and a group of Chagos Islanders who were forcibly evicted by Britain half a century ago to make way for a US military base there.
Louis-Olivier Bancos, who is the leader of the Chagos refugee group, speaks here after arriving in Chagos after many years.
Welcome everyone in our birthplace. This trip is so important. I've never had a media coverage who can send all my message to see how my island was before the installation of U.S. military base. If we were white people, with blue eyes, maybe we will have better treatment. We are not asking more. We are not asking less. We are asking our right as human beings. Thank you, my brothers and sisters.
Well, for more on efforts to liberate Chagos Archipelago illegally occupied by Britain, we contacted Keith Harmon-Snow, a journalist, writer, and activist. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first, what is the significance of this move by Mauritius to officially challenge Britain's colonization of Chagos Islands?
Well, Mauritius has for years now been fighting for the sovereignty of the control of these islands, which were originally under Mauritius' control. And, of course, that's been denied. They've taken it through the international courts, and now there have been two favorable rulings that basically say that Britain is required to give the territory back, the archipelago, back to Mauritius. And, of course, the United States and Britain being the primary power brokers in control of the Chagos Archipelago are not going to yield to any minor player like Mauritius or even a more major player. And give up this territory.
The United Kingdom has acted in total impunity by ignoring United Nations and African Union calls for it to vacate the Chagos Islands. In 2019, the International Court of Justice backed Mauritius and said Britain should give up control of the Chagos Islands.
The United Kingdom is under an obligation to bring an end to its administration of the Chagos Archipelago as rapidly as possible, thereby enabling Mauritius to complete the decolonization of its territory in a manner consistent with the right of peoples to self-determination.
What is the importance of Chagos Islands, and why is Britain trampling upon the international law to continue its illegal occupation of this Indian Ocean archipelago?
Well, the Chagos Archipelago is strategically located off the coast of Africa, not far from Madagascar, east coast of Africa, just south of South Asia. It's and halfway across to Indonesia and Australia. So its strategic importance can't be understated. The United States and Britain use it as a military base. Diego Garcia is the only island in the archipelago that's occupied at present.
Between 1968 and 1974, the UK forcibly evicted thousands of Chagosians from their homeland and exiled them to Mauritius and the Seychelles, where they faced extreme poverty and discrimination. The UK even handed one of the islands, Diego Garcia, over to the US, which then fully militarized it by developing a base there.
A lawyer for the indigenous inhabitants of Diego Garcia elaborates here on how they were tricked and later evicted to pave way for the illegal US military base.
It was entirely improper, unethical, dictatorial to have the Chagosian put the thumbprint on an English legal drafted document where the Chagosian, who doesn't read nor speak any English, let alone legal English, is made to renounce basically all his rights as a human being.
Back to Mr. Hammond. Now, how is the United States facilitating the continued colonization of Chagos Islands by Britain?
Well, the United States and Britain are, partners in crime all over the world. They're very close. Clearly, it's in the interests of Britain, as the base was built by the United States. Britain has complete access to it. It's joint staging ground for the both of them. So it's not like the United States is twisting anybody's arm to get Britain to support our operations there or allow the United States to continue operations there. It also should be mentioned that the Chagos Archipelago is rich in oil and gas deposits. And, clearly part of Mauritius government seeking to take control of its own territory is based around, for example, Jean-Raymond Bouel, who is one of the most powerful individuals in the world. American Mineral Fields International was one of his mining companies that operated in the Congo, very close to the Clinton family. And, they want control of the oil and natural gas, and they'll do anything to get it.
The African Union urged Britain to comply with the UN resolution and reiterated the AU's support for a complete decolonization of the Chagos Islands. In his address to the UN General Assembly, Prime Minister of Mauritius reiterated his call for Britain to stop its colonization of Chagos Islands.
Mr. President, it remains a matter of concern that more than 2 years after the International Court of Justice ruled that the decolonization process of Mauritius has not been lawfully completed in view of the unlawful accession of the Chagos Archipelago from its territory prior to independence, and that the United Kingdom has an obligation to withdraw its unlawful administration from the Chagos Archipelago as rapidly as possible, we still see no action on the part of the colonial power. And yet, The findings of the ICJ have been affirmed by the UN General Assembly Resolution 73/295. And in January this year, a special chamber of ITLOS has held that those authoritative determinations of international law by the ICJ have binding legal effect, rendering it beyond legitimate dispute that Mauritius is sovereign over the Chagos Archipelago as an integral part of its national territory.
The people of Chagos have been relentless in fighting for decolonization of their islands and their reunification with the Republic of Mauritius. Now, most international legal channels have been exhausted, and Britain is adamant on continuing its occupation of Chagos Islands, the last remaining colony of the British Empire. Now, Mr. Hammond, our last question to you. What options remain for the people of Chagos to liberate their territory?
Well, clearly the Chagosian people have rights that have been trampled on, beginning with their forcible exile, removal back, you know, from 1966 to 1971. We're only talking about, you know, a thousand people at the time. You know, apparently their families have grown substantially. So that's, you know, it's not a large number of people, but they still have rights to this territory. Again, the United States, Britain, Israel don't care about international law. They don't care about humanitarian law. The politics of genocide are such that our governments commit crimes anytime they like, pretty much, and get away with it. And so the Chagosian people, the only real recourse that they have is to get the word out. I mean, if Americans who are opposed to the war, opposed to American military, permanent military operations, our permanent warfare economy, if the United States people and the Canadian people and the European people and Australians could stand up against the system and realize that Diego Garcia, this military base, is the most important base in the region. Shutting down that base and returning the land to the Chagosian people would be a huge, huge win for peace in the world.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hammond, for your insight on efforts to liberate Chagos Islands currently illegally occupied by Britain. Now, there you have it. The liberation of Chagos Islands will require international support. Well, our time is up for today. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.